This year marks the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. Commemorations are celebrating wins on the battlefield and international cooperation and mourning the millions of lives lost. But there's been less talk about the war's impact on the lives of those who served and their families. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. My guests today have researched the military service of each of their fathers, and they're here to discuss what they learned. Joining me in this recorded interview are historian Dan Hurley, who wrote about his father's service in a book called Crossing Borders, Expanding Boundaries, A White Soldier's Experience of the World War II Segregated Army, and Al Gerhardstein, a civil rights lawyer who compiled an illustrated scrapbook documenting his father's service in the war. Thank you both for being here.
Great to be here, Lucy.
It's good to see you.
Let me start with you, Dan. How did you discover the details of your father's service in World War II? This was quite a journey for you.
Well, let's make clear right from the beginning, he never talked about his experience in the war or barely talked about it. What I knew about it, I knew more from my mother than from my father. My father died in 1977, and I never got to the point of trying to sort of open that up. If he had lived a little bit longer and lived to the 40th and 50th anniversaries of the war, he might have opened up. A lot of vets did. It's not uncommon for veterans of any war not to want to talk about their experience. What I became aware of was that my mother had saved my father's letters, and she had a scrapbook plus two diaries that he kept. I knew that in the last decade of her life, she lived till she was 94, that she reread the letters several times. They brought her a lot of comfort. My father's, their relationship was the most important thing in her life, I think. She told me she was going to give them to me. She knows what I do as a historian, and I'm sure she knew I would do something. And what I thought I would do was something for my siblings and our grandchildren. I didn't imagine it a book. It's only after I got into the letters, which turned out to be 720 letters, did I realize that this touched on a lot of much larger issues than just the personal issues. All of a sudden, I began to see that this was something that a set of stories that could be instructive for a lot of people and a different approach to the war. It's not about battles. It's not about strategies. That's the backdrop. It's really about the human side of coping with being in the Army and experiencing the world in a much larger way.
Al, I feel like your scrapbook accomplishes some of that same thing to kind of show what your dad went through in the war. How did you discover the details of your father's service?
Well, first, I just want to compliment and commend Dan. This is a great achievement, and you've taken a lot of primary source materials and turned it into something that's very accessible. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And this is a real book. Mine's just a recycled scrapbook, but we were after the same thing. This is for my family, for my brothers and our family. And it's based on a scrapbook that my mom kept and that my one of my aunts kept. I had five uncles who were in the Pacific and Italian theaters, and then I had two in the European theater, my dad and a couple and another uncle. So we had people all over the world. Like you, Dan, my dad never talked about it. But I did witness, he was a medic, and we had a high-speed four-lane highway next to the farm I grew up on. And one time there was this crash right in front of the house, and my dad was out there, you know, treating the victims of the crash before I even knew what happened. He had tourniquets on him, he had everything. And so that taught me that this was still with him, and he was very impacted by everything he experienced there.
Well, like so many couples of this era, both of your fathers were essentially newlyweds when they started serving in the military. They had to leave their wives behind, their plans behind to be part of the war effort. I'll start with you, Al. Do you know how your dad and mom felt about that and, you know, about that separation so early on in their marriage?
His letters don't tell me. His letters are news bulletins to the extended family, and they're very informative, and he writes beautifully and with great penmanship, but there's no sweetheart stuff going on in these bulletins. But I will say that he was one of the few that when he had an opportunity to bring my mom out to the training camps, she went. And so they had a little apartment in Tacoma. They had an apartment in Salinas, Kansas. And so they felt strongly enough about it that he wanted her close.
Yeah.
And that says a lot.
What about you, Dan?
These letters reveal a lot about their relationship. Now, they're, on one sense, they're one-sided. It's my father's letters that got saved. He didn't save my mother's letters for obvious reasons. He's not going to cart them around. But you hear her voice. He's always responding to a question that she's asked. There's a great deal about that personal relationship that becomes very clear. You know, sometimes we think of World War II soldiers as being volunteering at or being drafted at 18 or 19 or maybe even 17 and sneaking in. That wasn't my father. My father had already graduated from Xavier University and from the YMCA law school. There was so much that was set. He was 27 by the time he was drafted, and he revealed a lot about what he thought their relationship was and could be, including, and I included it in the book, is the first crisis in their marriage, and that's when he was sent off to Camp Butner to serve, to be an officer with this truck company that was made up by African-American enlisted men. And that sort of took my mother by surprise because they had sort of been able to stay in pretty close touch up till that point. So there was a crisis, and that is revealed. He doesn't write mushy letters, but the letter on Christmas Eve of 1944 still in France, but right on the border of Germany, it gets as close to it as possible. And it's a really touching letter, too. So there's a lot of variation here.
You mentioned, Dan, your father was an officer. He was assigned over this segregated all-black quartermaster company. Did that surprise you when you learned that from his letters and journals?
Absolutely. I had no idea about that. My father politically was very conservative. I knew that he was conservative. I knew he was Republican. Remember, in Northern Kentucky, where our family grew up, that was a Democratic state. So being a Republican, being Catholic, he was extremely conservative, hated FDR. He expressed those sorts of attitudes, didn't express any particular interest in African Americans until he gets assigned to this truck company. Here's the interesting thing. He didn't know it was going to be all the enlisted men, all 130 enlisted men were going to be African-American until he got to the camp. He literally, it was like in his first letter, he says, this is a colored company. He didn't have any idea about that. Within 2 weeks, he's saying, this has changed my view of the Army. For the first time in the 18 months or so that he had been in the Army, he had found it a diversion from his real life, a discouragement. He wasn't tuned into the Army. But he says then, I now have purpose. And he really grabbed onto this as something he wanted to do and needed to do. And here's a really interesting part. Now remember, this is not just the enlisted men being African American. There are five quote unquote white officers. The captain and one other lieutenant are Jewish. So as the German army is collapsing, every morning they were coming out of the woods and surrendering to American units. They didn't want to surrender to Russian units. They wanted to surrender to American units. And my father twice made the observation that he saw the irony in the fact that here are these Nazi soldiers, some SS, being guarded by American colored boys under the command of an American Jewish captain. And he saw that explained a whole lot about the war.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things my dad reflected on, because both of our dads kind of followed a similar route across France. I think mine was a little earlier, but in Germany as well. And my dad kept wondering about the nature of the French people and then the nature of the German people. And he was struck by how much poverty he saw in France and how many of the houses were like barns and the animals are on one side and the humans are on just the other side of the stall. And the, you know, they had ox and it was just really very destitute. And then he gets to Germany and he sees all the French wine in the houses and a lot of the booty from the war. And he's reflecting that, you know, you can't say the people were totally distanced from what their soldiers were doing. They were benefiting. They were partaking of all of what was captured in France. He was very moved, just very thoughtful about that.
And my father had another little twist on that, which was he actually saw that the culture that he experienced in Germany, there was a lot to be admired there. And he makes the comment, if we ever come back to Europe, if we ever visit Europe, writing to my mother, which they never did, by the way, if we ever go back to Europe, Germany's the place that's worth going to. France was seen as backwards, impoverished. And of course, northern France had really taken the brunt after Normandy.
Yeah, and my dad, the same thing. He thought the Autobahn was amazing. He thought the houses were really well built. He thought that the organization of the villages was very smart. The wooded areas where they could hunt were all manicured, and it was all very impressive to him.
We're talking in this recorded interview about the impact that World War II had on the lives of the people who served and their families. Each of my guests has researched their father's military service during the war. Al, we mentioned earlier your father was a medic. Was he on the front lines of the war in Europe? I mean, what kind of danger did he face?
He was on the front lines. In fact, some of the articles that I saved for this scrapbook were about whether medics should get combat pay. And, you know, the articles make it clear that the medics are out there, you know, with bullets whizzing by even more than the infantry soldiers themselves, who can sometimes just hunker down and, you know, pick their shots. But the medics are crawling around and trying to save people's lives. And it was obvious that they should be getting combat pay. And it was a big, you know, celebration when they finally did get recognition for that. And that's part of what he didn't talk about much. But when he did, I don't know if this is what you found on this, Dan, but I think my dad ended up like with the same people through the whole war experience, and most of them got killed. I mean, it was a terrible experience. So he'd tell us about somebody after a couple of beers and we're playing poker, and then he'd say, and I saw him get blown up. That's in his head. So it was very troubling. But poker brings up one other thing. My dad was also older. He was 31 when he went into the service. And he just felt like he was stealing money from the kids. They would play poker. He would win all the time. He'd send it right back to my mom. They saved $9,000 in his poker earnings, and he bought a house when he got home.
Wow. Well, both of your fathers were Catholic. Both wrote to your mothers about either missing Mass or attending Mass. Dan, what role do you think faith played in your dad's experience in the military?
When they entered Germany in 1945, early 1945, they drive south towards Bavaria. And they get into Bavaria, which is a very Catholic area. And they get in there at the time of Easter. And he sees all these public demonstrations going on, children in their First Communion finery processing to the church. And his first reaction is, this seemed familiar to him. This gave him reassurance. Within a week, there's another letter. He says, wait a minute, this is also the home of the Nazi movement. What happened here? How did these Catholics end up being such strong supporters of Hitler and the Nazi movement? That really seemed to hit home for him. I think he's thinking all the time about the role of religion in his own life, but also culturally.
What about for your dad, Al?
Oh, he was a devout Catholic. He didn't make a big deal out of it at home. But boy, these letters bring it up. He had Christmas in 1944 in a bombed out church that he writes about, and it's right on the front lines. You can actually see the German just a ways off, and their artillery shells and machine gun fire, and he says they're ducking down in the what's left of the pews from time to time. It's very, very moving. But he also, Dan, to confirm your point, he would explain to my mom that it's okay that he didn't say confession first, and he still took communion. And there was something called, and he explained it, a general absolution, and that was okay in wartime. And just all these exceptions. He didn't have to fast. You're okay. You don't have to fast. You know, all these rules that can be bent in times of war. And he was very taken by an extended letter about St. Teresa something, and some saint that was in Germany, and the Germans had protected her from her town, and he wrote extensively about how the wafers would float across her house into her mouth, and she hadn't eaten for 18 years, and he just felt like he was somehow near the presence of some amazing, you know, mystical experience, and that made him closer to God. And I say whatever works in that situation is fine by me.
Al, your father was involved in liberating prisoners of war. Talk to us about what he saw and how he wrote about that.
Yeah, he did write about that. There's two things. One I picked up from your book, Dan. Right before they liberated Bad Orb, which was a prisoner of war camp, he came across one of those factories that you wrote about that was underground. Mm-hmm. And it was the most advanced thing he had ever seen, with high tech for the time, machinery and all kinds of stocks of food. And I forget what they were making, but he was very impressed by that. And they were using prisoners of war to work in the factory, mainly Poles. One of his comments was, they just turned the other way and let the prisoners take all the food because, you know, they deserved it. Mm-hmm. And then they went 30 miles across the lines to free prisoners of war from Bad Orb, which was like a 6,000-person prisoner of war camp, lots of Russians, Poles, English, French, and some Americans. And he said that the stories just really, he understated it. I'm sure he said, put a lump in my throat. They were emaciated. They were full of bed bugs. They were just totally wasted. I think he felt good to be able to be part of that effort. And as a medic, he had to treat them.
Well, and Dan, your father helped liberate one of the concentration camps.
He helped liberate Dachau. Now, this doesn't mean he was there the first day, but he was there sort of the first week, to the point where he had a camera with him. In fact, all of the photographs in the book are out of his camera. Now, these are little tiny, you know, 3x2 photographs, which we had to really work on. But from Dachau, there are several photos. I only use one of them, of the literally the piles of bodies. There's also another really important photograph of a barracks where some survivors are seated and just sort of, they look morose and they look trying to get themselves together. And a third photograph from another visit into Dachau where he and his captain, Sherman Horowitz, are being led around and by a Polish survivor. And my father isn't in that photograph because he was taking the photograph, but Sherman Horowitz was standing on the porch out in front of the crematorium and small gas chamber. Dachau was not an extermination camp, but it did have a small gas chamber. The Polish soldier is down on the ground talking to him, and having read a lot about survivors and what they needed in the immediate liberation period, one of the things that Elie Wiesel and others talk about is the biggest thing was they needed to tell somebody the story in their own words and look people in the eyes and sort of reestablish their humanity. I comment in the book, you know, I don't know how much could they understand each other. Here was Sherman Horowitz. He was from America, but he did speak German. Did this Polish survivor possibly speak a little bit of German? And then I was giving a presentation at Mercantile Library, and afterwards somebody came up who was Jewish, and he said, maybe they were speaking Yiddish. Mm. And I had never thought of that. I don't know that Polish survivor was Jewish, but that could have been the common language. But it's that sort of thing that just opens up all kinds of possibilities.
Did either of you feel like in doing this research, you learned things about your father that you didn't know before?
Well, I certainly did. I mean, this is a guy who worked hard. He was a truck driver, and then he ran a farm. This is an area of his life, 3 years of his life, in a very formative time that we just didn't know much about at all. And here we learn from these letters that he was soaking it all in. He was sharing it with his family. He talked about the horror of it. One of the things he was able to do was get a short pass from the front lines after being on the front lines for 4 months. And he had a short pass to go to Paris. While he was in Paris, everything was free. If you're from the front lines, you go to the best restaurants, everything's free. The army took care of everything. And he was able to get his twin brother, who was serving in Italy, to join him, who he found sleeping in a chair at a hotel lobby. And his joy was just so obvious to be together. So those are very special things that I wouldn't have known had I not taken this on.
Same thing for me. I learned so much. Some of it's mundane. Growing up, I was a day hop. I was at Xavier University. I lived at home. When I sort of decided I was going to major in history, there was the usual response at home of, what are you going to do with that? And my father's point was, well, you can always go to law school. You know, I went to law school. I never practiced law. I went into business. He was in the savings and loan business. And it was like, oh, you can always do it that way. He always said he never practiced law. In these letters, it turns out he was prosecuting cases for over a year, both in the United States and even after he got to Europe, because he was probably one of the few lawyers in this particular camp that he was in. So I found out those kinds of things. I also found a level of perceptiveness on my father's part, his ability to see and describe beneath the surface of what things meant. The letter he wrote after his first trip into Dachau is the pivot point for me of the entire book. His ability not just to describe the horrors of what happened. In fact, he does that, but not in any great detail. What he says to my mother is, what if we had grown up in this culture, in this society? Would we have been different? Would we have stood up, in effect? I hope so, but I'm not sure. And if those of us in the next generation or in generations in the future want to use the phrase never again, we have to be willing to ask ourselves the question, would I stand up? Would I be, in the terms of the Holocaust Humanity Center here in Cincinnati, would I be an upstander, or would I just go along with things? And his ability to turn the question on himself, I think, is just fascinating.
My dad served with yours, and 16 million people Americans were in uniform. And I can't say that my dad complained. He didn't complain in any of these letters or when the few times he spoke about it. But in the letter describing Paris, he talked about going back to the horrors of the front line. That was tough.
Yeah. And like you said, he kept that in his head for his whole life. Well, I've been talking with historian Dan Hurley, who wrote about his father's service in a book called Crossing Borders, Expanding Boundaries, A White Soldier's Experience of the World War II Segregated Army, and Al Gerhardstein, a civil rights lawyer who compiled an illustrated scrapbook documenting his father's service in the war. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.